Well, I just wanted to thank everybody for having me here tonight, and thank you for being here. It's always enjoy meeting people from other parts of the state, and it was quite a beautiful trip from Richmond. My name's Lana. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, I always had a tough time before I came to the rooms identifying myself as an alcoholic because I didn't have the craving right away. My mom is a Russian Orthodox person, and she gave us wine as kids. You know, we would have wine with Christmas dinner and with Easter dinner, and I don't remember having to have more alcohol at that point. And I remember hearing when I first came in the rooms of AA the first time that people craved it from the get-go, and that was not the case for me. Mine came along a little more slowly. And I remember in high school, I was the goody-two-shoes kid. Not that I was part of the smart crowd, but I remember not fitting in. You hear that a lot in the rooms, but I really, truly didn't fit in. I wasn't part of the smart crowd, the beautiful crowd. Wasn't really athletic, but I was a gymnast in high school. And usually, I'm from Botetourt County, actually, and I remember for excitement, we would go over to my boyfriend's house and wax his truck, and we only had a six-pack. And I know that sounds pretty wimpy. Usually, we drank to get a buzz. I remember my best friend, Allison, and I, she came from a good Baptist family. You know, it's not very often we got in trouble. But we usually drank just to get a buzz, and I know that sounds pretty wimpy for an alcoholic, but at that point in time in my life, that's where I was. It wasn't until I was about 4 years sober that I realized one episode in high school may have been a sign that I had a problem with alcoholism. I was so naive. I'm living proof that you can be naive and be an alcoholic. I didn't know what grain was, and I was celebrating one night because actually I was going to state. I passed the regionals all around as a gymnast from a little dinky AA school called Lord Botetourt. And I went with a handful of friends to our house to celebrate. And it was a perfect setup because the parents were gone, fully stocked bar. And so we, you know, we went on, partied. And I remember trying Connie's grain. And it was not really a labeled bottle. It was in this beautifully painted bottle. And I remember they introduced grain to me. And you know, it's funny. I had no intention of getting drunk that night. I was just going to drink and get a buzz like I usually had. You know, been drunk a couple of times in high school. Well, something happened that night. I remember hanging with my friends for a few minutes, and then the next thing I know, after I had a couple of shots of grain in me, I was isolating in Connie's room. Everybody's in the other room having their party, being sociable. I'm in Connie's free floater waterbed drinking grain. Not a good combination. Don't recommend it. And you know, it was like that night I could not quit drinking it. It's like I got there, but there kept disappearing when I had to keep going to the bathroom. So I kept trying to get there again. And next thing I know, I'm sick. I'm in the bathroom. I'm puking everything up except my toenails. And after a while, they're like, "What's happened to Lana? Let's go check on her." And I remember Robin and her new boyfriend, Robbie, made a good impression on them. They just stood there in the doorway and said, "Man, it stinks in here." And, you know, so much for looking good in front of the guys, you know, at 16. And I remember walking a straight line home sideways, and my mom probably knew I was drunk. My father was an alcoholic. It was a good combination. Mom was manic depressive. Dad was an alcoholic. We did have exciting times. A lot of drama. But Mom was kind of used to it, and she probably figured I got drunk. And, you know, it's funny. She didn't lecture me. She just put me to bed and took care of me. And, you know, I swore after that night I would never drink grain again. And you know, I was even a teetotaler for a while in high school. I ended up going to VCU, not that I was really prepared for college or that I was a student, but I just always knew I was going to college. You know, my life is managed by me. I ended up going to VCU. I was a teetotaler for about a year because that next-door neighbor, that nice family, they kind of got me into the church. And I'm not proselytizing by any means, but this is just part of my story. And maybe higher power protected me and kept my disease from progressing as quickly as it probably could have. But for a while, they had a real influence, a good influence on me, and life was good. Went to college, got scared because I didn't have the family and support system around me. Even if it was a crazy support system, it was a support system. I remember just being terrified when I was at school. And being the teetotaler, I got involved in several churches, which was a good thing. I was hanging with the charismatics at the time who said that Jesus didn't turn the water to wine, he turned it to grape juice. So even though I didn't like that idea, just to conform and to look good to my friends and to fit in, because I wanted so badly to fit in, I didn't drink. I met my husband, good guy, in college, and he's not an alcoholic. We've been married 19 years. My husband can have one or two and leave it alone. Okay? I met my husband in college, and I remember looking at Randy and saying, "You're a Christian and you drink," and because at that point in time in my life, I was anti-alcohol. And the reason I tell that is so ironic that once I got alcohol, it turned out to be the real thing. Well, after hanging with my husband and dating him for a couple of years, I changed, I modified my thinking on drinking. Okay, modified drinking's okay. If you're moderate, I guess modified. Moderate drinking is okay. And as a matter of fact, I do believe that today, too, that moderate drinking is okay. I'm just not one of those people that can do it. But I remember... for a while, I probably looked like a moderate drinker, at least out in public. I used to work my evening shift at Sheltering Arms. I'm a nurse, and my husband worked evening shift teaching violin. And we'd meet over at Davison, Maine, over in the Fan in Richmond, and he would have dinner, and I'd have one or two whiskey sours. No more, no less. You know, no problems, no obvious problems. Plus, if we did drink a little too much, we could walk anywhere in the Fan. We didn't take the car, because, you know, parking's a big problem there. But, I guess my drinking progressed. It wasn't as obvious because I was not really a mobile drunk. I was more of a kitchen drunk. I would put a half a cup of wine in the chicken and then drink the rest while I was cooking. And after a while, you know, why bother with the glass? Just drink it from the bottle because it's another glass to wash and we have enough work to do. I didn't remember this episode until a while later. My father's from Bulgaria, and we used to sing this Bulgarian song. And it was a real treat for my husband after I'd had a bottle of wine, and I turned the CD on of the song Dad and I used to sing. And it got, you know, it gets kind of loud when we're drunk, right? So my husband is treated to a drunk wife singing Bulgarian music loudly at 2 in the morning, and nevertheless, he's yelling out the door, "Shut up!" And he's a nice guy. He was not happy that night. But, you know, I don't have this exciting hair-raising drunkalogue, but my drinking progressed. Usually, I think when I was working the night shift, I'd drink to get to sleep, so I thought. But see, if you're an alcoholic like me, I have a physical craving for alcohol. Once it's in me, I'm going to need more and more and more and more. And you know, I used to drink things like tequila and beer, and it used to be the nice beers, like the 12-pack of Moosehead, or I guess that's nice beer. For me, that's expensive. And Foster's Lager did taste better in the can, but after a while, as my drinking progresses, I moved from the night shift to the day shift in the recovery room. I would drink just to celebrate making it through another day. I thought the people I worked with were a rough crowd, and I would have to have a couple of beers at the end of the day. I did it again. I worked, you know. It's like I could not cope with life, and drinking somehow got Lana out of the way so that I could function and live in this fixer-upper house and raise my son and get things done. I could never get my wheels on the ground unless I had alcohol in me, it seemed, and then I could function. Once I had a couple of drinks, my thinking was cleared. The anxiety was eased up. I felt like life was a little better. I wasn't quite as scared. And it seemed like I was able to do things. And, you know, I guess God was gracious all through my life. I had a lot of almosts. My husband still worked evenings. By now he's working days. My son was about two and a half. And there was a night when I remember my little guy, he learned how to turn the doorknob on the front door. And I was in the kitchen cooking, and I heard this knock on the door, and a lady was standing there with my son holding his hand. My little guy, I live on a really busy street called Huguenot Road in Richmond. My little guy was out by the mailbox. He could have been road meat, you know. I was not a safe mom, so, I mean, I guess God, you know, higher power is gracious to me in drunkenness and sober, and in sobriety or undrunkenness. I had gotten to the point where my husband asked me questions about my drinking, and I just thought it was so ironic because I remember accusing him a few years back of, you know, drinking and being a Christian. And at this point in time in my life, I was buying the case of beer because it was economical. You know, back then Bud was about $13 a case, and it was supposed to last longer, you know, like a week or two. When it started lasting a night or two, my husband asked about my drinking, which is annoying because I had found my solution. You know, I could drink and be happy and get projects done. I was clearing out a backyard that was overgrown, and it just made the home tolerable because I didn't really have to look at it. At this point in time, I was alienated from my family. Mom had died just 2 months before Ben was born, and so, you know, I wasn't in the best relationship with my remaining two sisters. Half of our family's gone. And I would drink before my sister would come over and visit, or I'd drink before I had to call my other sister in New York because I could not tolerate them. I had a lot of old ideas. And I remember when Randy started asking me questions about my drinking, I decided to hide it because I'm not about to give up the solution. And I knew a little bit about alcoholism because I took care of alcoholics as a nurse. And I remember the Jelinek chart. Maybe some of you have seen them if anybody's been in treatment or had a psychiatrist or psychologist. But I remembered that one thing about the chart where it says people start asking you about it. And I didn't know much about alcoholism, but the fact that he asked me about it, even though I wasn't ready to surrender the fact that I was an alcoholic, something did click for just a brief second. I realized that I might have a problem, but I wasn't about to give up my solution. I don't remember trying to quit before I came in the room. So my desperation was an emotional, spiritual one. So I hid it. I made it a point not to stick the case in the fridge. I would just keep six in the fridge and rotate them. It was a lot of work. I would rotate them, but then while I'm waiting for those to get cold in the freezer behind the peas, I drink a hot one down a hot one to keep the buzz going, So it took a sponsor in sobriety to show me that this is not normal drinking. Normal drinkers don't go through those calisthenics to keep it going. But I did that. I'm not even sure what period of time. It's kind of a cloud. But I think I was at a point in time in my life where I felt dead inside. And I had philosophical convictions galore, as it says in the big book. I had a good framework. I had good people in my life that taught me right from wrong and absolutes that do work in life. And my thinking still strayed from good teaching and caring, loving people. I'm not one of those people who's resentful against the church because of, how they made me do things. They told me about love and kindness and tolerance and patience. They were tolerant of me and very loving. And they told me God doesn't make junk. So I had no excuse. But the thing is, my thinking, the alcoholic thinking and then the alcoholic drinking is what led me down that path because I was the big victim. I had the big V on my forehead. I was convinced that being raised by my manic depressive mom who didn't teach me how to cope with life was my problem and that I have nothing going for me because they didn't give me the tools to live life. That was a huge, huge resentment. And, I got a lot of mileage off of that for many years. And, I didn't get any freedom from it until a sponsor took me through inventory and helped me look at it from a different angle. I mean, even well into sobriety, I'm still getting rid of old ideas, and I'll get to a recent story, after I go through some of the chronology of this. But I ended up in the rooms because of a counselor. She knew alcoholism. She said, I'm not going to treat you or I'm not going to be with you or work with you until you go to an outpatient program. This is called intensive outpatient. Well, intensive outpatient was good. I mean, it introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know and hear still that I was an alcoholic. I would sit there in the rooms and go through the motions because I'm a people pleaser. And I said, yeah, I'm Lana, I'm an alcoholic. And I would go through the motions and do the next right thing in their eyes to keep them off my back. And I stayed undrunk, as Al said, for about a year and a half almost. But I had no solution in my life because my eyes, it's like, okay, well, look at me. I'm getting counseling. I'm trying to turn my life around. So I immediately set on my husband to fix him. And fix our lives, as if I had any qualifications to do that now that I'm newly sober. And I ended up drinking. I was bringing a friend home from an AA meeting, and I remember him saying, hey, why don't buy me some beer? And I'm like, you're crazy. You're an alcoholic. I'm not going to buy you any beer. After a while, I was buying it for him, and then I was drinking it with him. So I really was not sober that year and a half that I didn't have a drink in me. I reached a new emotional spiritual bottom because when I violate spiritual principles, my life turns messy again. And I guess I had that gift of desperation because I was in pain again. And this time, I guess my desperation was sufficient for me to have a little bit of willingness and to listen to, find a sponsor and listen to them. I used to have sponsors in name only because it's annoying when people say, hey, do you have a sponsor? And this way I can say, yeah, I have a sponsor. And it's like, get off my back. But this time I found somebody. I found a meeting about a mile down the road from my house that had babysitting. That got my attention. And it was convenient because it was near my home and it was on Friday night. That was easy to get to. And it was interesting because this meeting, I thought AA meetings were something you go to spill your guts. You know, I had a lot of psychological background from counseling, and I remember studying group theory and therapy and stuff. And I thought that was where you go to spill your guts so you could feel better. And, you know, fortunately, this group I visited was not like that. They told enough of their story that I can identify, and they got my attention. But then they proceeded to tell about the solution in their lives, and that got my attention. Now, I kept trying to talk. They didn't let the newcomers talk, and that really ticked me off because I had a lot to say. But, you know, as a matter of fact, Alex, y'all know Alex, he was heading a lot of those meetings. I had to write inventory on him about 4 years later, and this is on tape, I know, because he wouldn't let me talk. But, you know, the reason, I didn't have anything to share. You know, I did not have a solution much, so thank God he didn't let me talk. It would have probably scared some people away. But, you know, they shared enough of the problem, and then they shared the solution, and they were laughing, they were telling stories that were treacherous, and they were laughing at it, and it got my attention. I noticed that they were happy. They were attractive to me, and it kept me coming back, even though I couldn't talk. That was annoying, but I ended up joining a home group. I ended up asking a lady to be my sponsor. She just was very attractive in what she said, and I asked her if she'd sponsor me. She said, well, sure, I'll sponsor you if you'll do a few things. And, you know, I sometimes thought people in the rooms were control freaks, but, you know, we don't come in on a winning streak. You know, my life wasn't exactly orderly and making sense, so I needed some structure. So she was giving me some structure. She said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to get together every week and read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how we take the steps. And I remember in that year and a half prior, when I was undrunk, I didn't have a drink in me, but I was just a maniac. I remember thinking, what does it mean to work the steps? I mean, do you memorize them off the wall? I didn't understand, and I couldn't get a straight answer. Maybe I wasn't hearing the answer, but she showed me that you do the steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't realize that. That was a news flash to me. So that was the first deal. We were to get together every week for at least an hour a week. She said the second thing was you go to three meetings a week. Now, I know different people hear different things, the 90 and 90, whatever, but her deal with me, her contract with me, if you will, was that I would go to three committed meetings a week. I could go to more, but at least three committed meetings. The third thing was I needed to have a home group and have a job in it. And she explained to me that a home group is a group I go to unless I'm dead sick or out of town. I'm there. I'm committed. I'm there. I've been there every Friday for 6 years, except for when I was sick or out of town. Thank God I haven't died yet. And the fourth thing was be willing to help other alcoholics. And I really didn't know what I was signing up for, but I think I was desperate enough at that point in time in my life that I just said, yes, 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 yes. I really had no clue what I was signing up for. I thought this was a self-help program. She was my counselor, my personal counselor. And, you know, it was really disconcerting when another lady showed up one day for both of us to go through the Big Book because I thought she was mine. But I later learned that this is an other help program, and that is what ultimately, maybe not ultimately, but that is a huge part of what keeps me sober, is getting out of self and being available for the other alcoholic once I have some kind of a message to put together for them. Not that I am the higher power, not that I'm God, but I can share the experiences I've been through and identify with another alcoholic and share with them my hopelessness. So a lot of times that's where people identify with me, is where I felt hopeless. And so second year of sobriety was rough. I had gone through the 12 steps, but I still didn't comprehend that this is an other help program, because in my mind, I was the hero. You know, I was the nurse, I was the Army Reserve officer, I was this, that, and the other, and I always was so selfish. I still didn't understand that I was so incredibly selfish. And I sponsored a lady. I picked a lady who was extremely sick, and because I wasn't going to let my new sister get ahead of me and have sponsors. I was having to sponsor people out of validation to be validated. I'm still trying to, you know, be somebody, because I felt like I was nobody all my life. That was a trip. It was a very interesting trip. We got through the book a year. She ended up drinking, and you know, I realized later on that I was sponsoring her out of my extreme selfishness, and God forgive me. I hope I stand ready to make amends if I need to. Third through 6 year have gotten better, you know. I guess I need to back up and backtrack on the steps. I guess with the fourth step, I had never before looked at people differently. I'm not going to say my first inventory was perfect by any means, and I'm not going to say I was clear-minded when I wrote it, but I think it was sufficient for higher power to create a change in me. And it was part of the 180, that psychic change that was starting to take place, the willingness to at least attempt it. I'm not going to say I worked these steps perfectly. And I end up fifth-stepping. My first fifth step was in three phases. And my sponsor was, get ready to get married. I can't remember. I think her washing machine was busted that night. Some emergency was happening in their house when I was doing my fifth step. She was still gracious enough to take time to listen to my fifth step, and she has life going on. And it was at the point where the crisis was such I had to leave. So Marcy got to hear the second part of my fifth step. And I thought this was serious stuff, and Marcy laughed at half the things I was saying. And I realized, you know, I can laugh at this stuff, you know, because I was telling her stories about my sister with schizophrenia and all the suicides, and we had a lot of drama in my family growing up. But it was funny because Marcy, I don't know, just her laughter helped make that 180 degree go a little further. And then I got to finish out with Val and then do 6, 7, and 8 immediately. Val taught me that you do 6 and 7 immediately after, otherwise it loses its effect. And I remember going, she let me stay at her house because I get too distracted at my house. I don't know, maybe ADD gets active once I step in my front door. But I was able to focus on 6 and 7 before my higher power and go through the steps. It was a little bit scattered, but, you know, higher power kept reining me back in. And then I made my list. And I remember the first set of amends. You know, I apparently might not have done that 4, 5, 6 real well because I was able to make a lot of my major amends. But my sister in town, one of my huge defects of character is jealousy because I'm fearful and I want people to see me a certain way. And I was big into image management. I could not make amends to my sister. And Val told me, pray for willingness. I had to pray for willingness for 4 weeks before I could actually go make the proper amends to her. And there were some amends where I actually, you know, wrote out some ideas to review how I would say things to them. And Val said, that's not an amends. Go rewrite that. Not that we write amends, but some of them, it just helped me to write them out. And I'm not saying send a letter. I wrote it out prior to as I was trying to think through what the proper thing was to say, which, of course, was I was wrong. I regret the harm I caused. And life started turning around, I think, with the ninth step. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to work with different alcoholics, sponsoring people. I think the biggest part of my 12th step work has been in Tucker's. I've been going to Tucker's Pavilion. It's a inpatient psychiatric unit and substance abuse unit over at Chippenham. And that, you know, I remember when I first started going there for about the first year, my husband said, when are you going to quit doing this? Because he didn't like the idea. But I don't know, I just never quit. And he's gotten used to it since then. And so I do need to take my family into consideration, but we have built that into our life. I go every Sunday night, whether I'm dead sick or out of town, whether somebody's taking my place tonight. And even if some of those people are in the Ativan haze, there is something special about going to Tucker's and talking to people, because actually there are a few people in our group who are attending either as home group members or just visitors who were up there and they heard something Jeremy and some of these other, and some things we've said that they identified with. And that's what it is. We're not up there to save people. We're just up there to bring our story, our experience, strength, and hope, and identify. You know, if they want to grab the life preserver, it's there, but we're not going to throw it at them. And you know, it's been a real privilege. One lady in our group is now the new Bridging the Gap coordinator, and she was there about 10 months ago. And it's just so cool to be around and seeing those things happen. It just gives you an energy that you've not had before. I'm grateful for Val's sponsorship and what she's taught me about 12-step work. I still have a lot to learn. I'm still on the learning curve about 12-step work. I've made all the mistakes in the book. I probably violated the 9 nevers in working with others. But it's kept me sober, and fortunately I do have a set of spiritual tools that I can use now to repair any damage I've done. I'm quicker today to say I was wrong, even in my home. You know, one of the toughest places to practice all your principles is in your home environment. And, you know, I have to go to my husband and my son many times and say, you know, I was wrong. What can I do to make it right? And you know, that happens in an hour or two instead of a week later. And you know, we actually have a pretty decent home life now, and it's because of this program. And I have a host of friends, you know, for a couple of years, and even in jaywalkers, I felt isolated, even in sobriety. I remember feeling like they're special, I'm not, you know, the big ego trip, the downward spiral, which is really self-centeredness. Still happens in sobriety, but fortunately I have 10, 11, and 12. I have the 10th step, which I'm still getting better and better at. God, take this thinking away. Direct my thinking. It's part of the 11th step prayer. Then how to tell somebody about it without it turning into something destructive, you know, I'm getting better at that. And then directing my thinking, making a deliberate decision to turn my will and life over to God and say, okay, God, how can I be useful now? That has been the only thing. This program has been the only thing that would break me out of that negative, self-centered, negative spiral of I'm useless, I'm crap, I can't do this, I'm stupid. You know, I would think those thoughts and stay in them and then be paralyzed with fear. And, you know, fortunately, I don't have to be a superhero today. I just need to be willing to be useful. And this program's, you know, teaching me and my friends that. And I have a real family in Jaywalkers and in my extended family and in other groups in AA. And I'm grateful for you asking me to speak. I don't have anything else to say that I can think of, but I'm willing to speak to you after the meeting if you have questions. Thank you for having me here.